What does the future hold for the Basel framework? Welcome to Global Risk Regulators podcast series about banking and financial regulation. For more information about GRR, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. In this episode, we are looking at how the Basel framework might be impacted by the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. The 2007 to 2009 global financial crisis led to significant revisions to the Basel framework. This had placed banks in a much better position to cope with the current global economic downturn. Nonetheless, the economic downturn this time has been deep, and the number of bad loans is expected to pile up, and it is happening against a backdrop of global political tensions and changing economic priorities. This raises a question over the future of global frameworks such as the Basel one, the threat of non-compliance and fragmentation, the growth of shadow banks, and the rise of sustainable finance. To address these points, I am delighted to welcome Bill Cohen, former Secretary General of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision and Chair of the IFRS Advisory Council. He also sits on the Board of Directors of the Toronto Centre, a global non-profit organisation that provides leadership training in financial supervision. And I'm also delighted to welcome Paul Sharma, a Managing Director at Alvarez & Marsal, who used to be a deputy head at the Prudential Regulation Authority and a former member of the Basel Committee. So the COVID-19 pandemic has had an enormous impact on the global economy, more so than the already very damaging 2007-2009 global financial crisis. How do you think the aftershocks from that might play out in terms of affecting the Basel framework?
Well, I think first it's important to recognize that in times of crisis, this is true of the global financial crisis. It's certainly true today.
Yeah.
And authorities, first and foremost, focus on market and financial stability. Everything else is somewhat of a second order question, a secondary consideration. And as examples, I think of the liquidity lines, injection of market liquidity, dollar swap lines, emergency assistance, and the like. So when it comes to the global rules, what we have seen so far, I think, is encouraging. We've seen flexibility, not forbearance, but flexibility of some of the rules. And as an example, I think of the announcements made by the Basel Committee and its governing body, the governors and heads of supervision. They've deferred implementation of some of the Basel III standards for 1 year. They've extended the related transitional arrangement. So I think that was, I think that was well done. And I think the quick and decisive actions of a lot of the national authorities, the Fed, the Bank of England, the ECB, I think they should be applauded. As long as the actions are temporary and are reversed in due course as planned. Of course, when conditions warrant. So I have absolutely no problem, and I could see the justification for temporary delays in implementing the regulatory revisions. Completely understandable, but stepping away from or diluting the previously agreed minimum global standards like Basel III on a permanent basis, that clearly my view is counter to the best interests of global financial stability.
Right.
The bottom line, I think what has been done so far has been fully warranted. I think the real test will come in hopefully a year's time when a lot of these temporary measures are set to roll off. So let's see what happens then.
No, indeed. And Paul, what's your view on this?
Yes, I think the economy might change quite profoundly. The real economy might change quite profoundly.
True, yes.
Both as a result of the temporary and even more so of the permanent consequences of the of COVID-19. If that is the case, I'm not sure I start with the view that the perfectly rational policy choices as to the degree of safety we would want from our banks, that those policy choices will necessarily hold. There is a trade-off between safety and growth.
Yeah,
it's a difficult trade-off, and in the long run, safety promotes growth. In the short run, the two can be moving in opposite directions from one another.
Yeah.
So I suspect there might be a need for a much more fundamental reappraisal of Basel standards.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, but as I say, it's not really. I disagree with Bill on anything technical to do with banks. It's more my view as to what I think is going to happen in the real economy.
Okay. Okay. Well, maybe this takes us very neatly to our sort of second question. Let's imagine the economic impact actually turns out to be really quite bad. We see a lot of bad debts piling up at the banks. And you know, when all the sort of payment holidays are over and all that sort of thing, could we see further revisions of the Basel framework? Maybe.
Let me go first, if I may.
Yeah, of course.
Justin. I think it's a nice segue from the point that Paul raised. So to answer your question, could we see further revisions to the Basel framework? My answer is an emphatic no.
Okay.
And why is that? I do think we're going to see a quite pronounced period of stress. How could we not with the NPLs that are surely coming our way in the U.S., the EU, the U.K., other jurisdictions? There's not a doubt in my mind. But then be very specific. What revisions could we think about? Because what the Basel Committee develops, minimum requirements, and I stress minimum requirements. I mentioned before the deferral or the delay in implementing the standards, but we're talking about specific revisions to minimum requirements. And the minimum requirements, it's not like a trade agreement or some kind of an arms treaty. We're talking about the bare minimum below which would be unsafe and unsound. I mean, let's use the leverage ratio example of 3%.
Yeah.
Goodness, we saw what happened in the global financial crisis operating with high leverage. I can't think of any of the measures that would really warrant a rethink. Now, and I'm assuming that Paul, you might have been thinking about a rethink of the standards, but probably on the lower side. I don't hear too often, except for some academics, I don't hear too often from people saying that the Basel minimum standards are too low. I do hear from some academics who say, yeah, no, we missed the mark. We should have been far more ambitious. So, Justin, my response to your question is no. I really don't think there's room to further revise the minimum requirements that the Basel Committee has produced.
Okay, so to kind of just you know, people are free to use that not very that bit horrible word, gold plate them if they wish to. They could make their bank system safer, which is what a lot of jurisdictions do anyway, such as Switzerland, the UK. So Paul, what's your take on this then?
So I fear that if the economy changes profoundly, there may need to be some aspects of the Basel standard that change quite profoundly. Let me pick just one.
Yeah.
The IRB approach, one uses past data to calibrate one's PDs and indeed one's LGDs.
Yeah.
Past data, there is a presumption that the past is representative of the future. And of course, we all understand that it's a lot more complicated than that. You filter the past for things that, you know, for things that are not going to repeat, and you add in things that perhaps haven't happened and are going to happen in the future. But that's basically it. Where you have a fundamental shift in the economy, the past becomes less valuable for the future. So let me take the analogous problem of how do you credit underwrite? How do you price credit risk at the moment? Yeah. Anybody pricing credit risk for a loan at the moment needs to think about whatever the history of the sector that they're financing. They need to think about a structural, not a cyclical, but a structural change in demand that may be occurring for that sector. And they need to think about, is that sector closed temporarily with a strong rebound, or is that sector closed and it will never go back to the way that it is? And for the former, I would say hairdressing is a good example of a sector that's closed temporarily but will rebound.
So there's a lot of pent-up demand there.
And if this were a sort of a video rather than audio, you'd see why I'm making that point. But for the retail sector, I suspect there will be no rebound. There will be a rebound, but then to nowhere near the current level. So the past has ceased to be anywhere near as informative about the future as it was hitherto.
Now, that's a really interesting point.
Yeah. That will need to be reflected in the implementation of the Basel framework.
Right. Okay. Bill.
Let me just quickly ask for clarification, Paul. So are you talking about just the operational aspect of Basel III, how PDs and LGDs are estimated, or are you talking about something more fundamental? Because I was talking about something more fundamental like calibration. Yeah. I'm acutely sensitive to the whole complexity issue, and that's something we grappled with since the development of Basel II. But if you're talking about something process related and how to estimate the risk parameters, that's fine. We could continue to think about that because we've thought about it for many, many years. But if you're talking about something more fundamental like calibration, I think that's what I was talking about. And I was thinking there really isn't any further room to revise downward what are already, in the view of many, very low minimum requirements.
Yeah, so I'm sort of making the bridge between the two because I suspect the disruption to the information, to the disruption for the future compared to the past will be such that we will not know what degree of confidence we have calibrated the Basel Accords to. Whether we keep the standards the same, whether we lower them, or whether we increase them, actually our ability to know what loss absorbency they have will be degraded. Yeah. Put simply, how do you know that you've got the right PDs? Well, we had a fairly good answer to that based on past data. We understood that there were some problems with the answer. In particular, we saw that in terms of comparability from one bank's PDs to another. But we had a fairly good answer to that. We were making progress on that. If the future is going to be significantly different from the past, we no longer have a good handle on that. We're no longer tuning to say, let's have safer or less safe banks, because we don't know to what extent, even keeping the standards constant, that the new circumstances have made the banks less safe.
So kind of need to start again with some of the data series, I guess, for particular industries. Yeah.
Yes.
And kind of re-rate their riskiness, I suppose.
Yes, and if you're pricing, so let's talk about pricing rather than capital and regulation. If you're pricing, that's exactly what you're going to have to do.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're going to have that kind of a rethink for pricing, that must have a knock-on effect for the amount of capital.
Okay, Bill, before we move on to the next question, do you have any final points you want to make on this?
No, I know Paul's saying, and I do agree on the pricing issue, and that leads to my major premise when we talk about capital. Capital is important. Of course it is. I devoted a significant part of my career to trying to get it right.
Sure.
But first and foremost, there are governance questions. There are the role of risk management, pricing, capital allocation within a firm. There are some things that are even more fundamental than regulatory capital. So I take that point. I think that's very important.
Okay, fine. Okay, actually, Bill, I'll start with you since you used to be Secretary General of the Basel Committee. You must have had a particularly good insight on this next question. You know, the world is becoming much more fragmented politically. We've got really quite high tensions between the West and China now. The US and EU aren't getting on particularly great, and there's India and China as well. Is there a risk that those geopolitical tensions could seep in to the Basel Committee's work, and you know, maybe even eventually erode confidence in the Basel framework?
You know, Justice, this is not a new question. This has been around even before the last global financial crisis. Now, I will say every representative on the Basel Committee, not surprisingly, has their own views. And those views have been informed by their personal national experience. So I really don't think geopolitical considerations are a big factor. Okay. I've already mentioned one reason: minimum prudential requirements. We're not negotiating trade agreements, arms treaties. We're talking about among central bankers and supervisory authorities. We're talking about trying to come to agreement on what constitutes a minimum prudential requirement. So that's sort of a common thread among Basel Committee members and those who participate in the process. But I also think the post-global financial crisis experience is really instructive here. There was, you know, you think back, and it wasn't that long ago, there was significant concern about supervisory or regulatory fragmentation. It turned out really not to be too much of an issue for the Basel Committee. And those were concerns that were really amplified when there was a change in the U.S. administration that became effective in early 2017 when President Trump took office. At that time, we were trying to finalize one of the biggest pieces of all the reforms, and that was the aggregate output floor. And people just threw their hands up in the air and they said, oh, it's never going to happen now. But
yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, look what happened.
Yeah, that was that's
very,
a good point.
Very substantive pieces of the Basel III jigsaw were finalized subsequently. In addition to the floor, all the other Basel III revisions on credit risk, operational risk, we had the fundamental review of the trading book that was finalized January 2019. So all of this occurred after a new U.S. administration where people thought, well, this is never, you know, this is never going to happen now. The other thing, let me just add, if you think about the Basel Committee membership, yeah, it includes China, the U.S., but includes 25 other countries. And about a half, really about one half of the Basel Committee is comprised of emerging market economies, Argentina, Brazil, China, Hong Kong.
Sure, yeah.
Russia, Saudi. I mean, it's roughly half. We engage closely with the IMF, who participates in Basel Committee meetings. We have observers like Chile, Malaysia, the United Arab Emirates that participate as observers, and we engage really with other countries through a process called the Basel Consultative Group, that has 21 other countries and a dozen other organizations. So it really is a global group, and there really is a global perspective when we look at these things. So I'm not concerned about.
Okay, you make a point on that very well. I mean, Paul, you've sat through many a Basel meetings and negotiations. You know, see how other countries behave and or representatives behave, and so on. What's your take on that? Do you think they'll manage to keep geopolitics out of Basel, out of the Basel Committee?
I think there is less commitment to agree for the sake of the global good.
Okay.
As compared to 5 years ago, as compared to 10 years ago. Having said that, I don't actually see it as being in particularly in anybody's interest to destroy the standards that are there.
Right.
Yeah. And it may well be in everybody's interest to agree some new standards. But if we were to get into a situation where, you know, where national interests were potentially at variance with the global good, I'm not sure the margin of the margin of deference, which was never perfect, but the margin of deference that individual countries will be prepared to pay to promote something that's to the global good. I'm not sure that's in the same place now as it was previously.
Right.
What I'd say on that. Now, where might that come up? If, for example, we have sort of environmental considerations starting to influence capital requirements, or if some countries want to promote a growth agenda, mm-hmm. As opposed to a safety agenda, you know, in each case, those cases for national interests reasons, or or for perceptions of global interest, I'm not sure that the coherence will be maintained. And I think part of the way that Basel, part of the path to maintain coherence is to stay narrowly focused on the important issue of bank safety rather than trying to achieve other purposes with what Basel is doing.
Right. Okay.
Paul, let me just jump in for a quick second, because earlier you said that a growth agenda and a safety agenda, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, particularly in the long run. So I don't agree with the premise that you have to choose one or the other, because in the long run, and I think we've gotten some good experience really in the last couple of years before the pandemic, the profitability, the health of banks in the US, Australia, you know, you just look around the world, you can see these two concepts of growth and safety, they're not mutually exclusive.
In the long run. I think either are inconsistent in the short run, or they may be, or which amounts to the same thing from a practical political point of view, they may be perceived to be inconsistent in the short run. And I think crises, economic crises, shift policymakers to think more about the short run.
Yeah, I'm wearing my, I can't help but seeing the world through a Basel Committee lens. Forgive me for that. And I think, developing global standards, minimum standards, they're developed to be in effect through a cycle. So we do take the long view. And I think, you know, what we're seeing today on issues like green finance, other ESG issues, I don't know if regulation or global standards like Basel, I'm not sure if that's the right avenue to address near-term socially desirable objectives. Basel mainly, almost exclusively, is prudential standards. And to go outside of that, I don't think it really is an effective, efficient means for addressing these other issues in the near term.
I mean, that neatly brings us on to our next question, because, you know, the EU wants to put climate change and sustainability as really front and center of their recovery program, you know, a Green Deal. Paul, what do you think about how that might influence, you know, their version of the Basel rules, CRR, CRD? Do you think some of the things they're discussing is the right way to go?
Yes, I think it would be very unfortunate, because I fully agree with Bill on this. I think it would be very unfortunate if the prudential regime for the regulation of banks were used for a purpose other than safety and soundness and financial stability.
Right. Yeah.
I think that would make it very difficult to agree prudential standards at a global level, because the countries can have different social objectives that they're wishing to pursue. I also think it would be I think it would make banks less safe. There would be, or to be more accurate, there would be less clarity as to the safety of the degree of safety that banks had if prudential requirements were set on the basis of social good.
Right.
That is not to say that there shouldn't be regulation of banks that aims at social good, but I don't think it should be through the mechanism of capital requirements.
Okay, fine. Yeah, so I think you kind of agree with Bill on that.
Yes.
Okay, maybe if we just move this along a bit, the future of bank supervision, you know, you've got all these issues we just talked about, you know, ESG, diversity, we've now got regulatory technology, artificial intelligence. I mean, could you give some views, Paul, as, you know, because I know you talk to banks and regulators a lot, as to where you think that's heading for?
So I think the most interesting one is the way technology, I beg your pardon, will change the economic role of the banks.
Okay.
There's a separate issue about the way regulatory technology may affect the way regulators interact with the banks, but the more profound issue is the way in which technology itself may change the role of banks within the real economy. I am not sure we will have the same need for financial intermediaries in general. I'm not sure we will have that same need.
What, because of fintechs? And
I mean, in a certain sense, I mean, this is not new. I mean, the capital markets themselves, for many, many decades, more profoundly in the US than in Europe, have been providing disintermediated ways of connecting sort of one part of the real economy that has an excess of funds to invest with another part that needs investment. I'm not so sure about the role of banks in that respect. I'm also not so sure about the role of banks, and indeed even central banks, in another respect, that is to say, as suppliers of money, creators and suppliers of money. I'm not sure the direction that will go in, but, you know, if we go down the path of modern monetary theory, I think that, I think we have a completely different banking system, and it may well be even the fiercest opponents are going down that path. If one looks at the degree of money creation financing that is going on of the real economy at the moment, if one goes down the path of blockchain technology and other forms of disintermediated money, one also has a completely different relationship between the banking industry and money creation.
Yeah.
So those are at least two profound ways in which we could just find in half a generation or a generation's time that banks play a completely different role and a much less significant role in the economy than they do currently.
Okay, that's quite a radical vision there of the future. I mean, Bill, coming to you, what's your take on, you know, bank supervision of the future?
Yeah, I mean, this has been one of the most interesting things to watch unfold and evolve over the course of the last 10 years. It was often a very welcome diversion from the mundane negotiation and hashing out of Basel III standards. It was fun. It was fun to work on, yep, on this and to try to see where this has taken us. I mean, I agree with Paul. We are still seeing a profound evolution in the role of banks and in the provision of finance in the real economy. But I do recognize banks are special. Deposit insurance, and the safekeeping of deposits at banks, the role that banks play. Of course, as Paul rightly said, this is all shifting. But for now, banks continue to be special. And on the point of supervision, there has always been, for as long as I've been involved in bank supervision regulation, it's 35 years, there's always been a concern, a supreme sensitivity to burden. And, you know, so on the one hand, we have great developments in fintech and reg tech, banks using fintech for compliance and regulatory reporting, and they've made great strides in that regard. Supertech, similarly, how could the supervisory process be made more efficient, more effective through the use of technology? So I think there's all organizations around the world, supervisory authorities, are paying close attention to that to see how they could take a greater advantage of technology. But the one thing that sticks in my mind is one of the really, from a supervisory perspective, one of the really important lessons learned from the global financial crisis. And that was the need for close on-site examination and inspection, particularly for the larger and more complex firms. There's no substitute for having an on-site presence to review loan files, for example, speak with loan officers, risk managers, senior management, and so forth. So it was fascinating for me to see during the post-GFC period, given this sensitivity to burden, but we started talking about supervisory intensity, supervisory intrusiveness as a positive thing, and I think the lesson was learned by several authorities worldwide that the lack of that kind of intensity or even intrusiveness or this on-site presence, I think a lot of organizations found out the real hard way that that was a mistake. So yeah. I do think that to sum up, SupTech for sure is changing the way supervisors think about overseeing a bank. But at the same time, there is this need for close, careful, intense engagement with management on the ground.
So basically, the hands-on approach should continue, really. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's just quickly sort of wrap this up now. Now, banks have long complained about shadow banks, that they're regulated differently. So a very quick one for you, Paul. Do you think there is an argument for the sake of financial stability to bring these so-called shadow banks under prudential frameworks?
Yes, but as soon as you do so, a further set of institutions come into existence that are shadow banks.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Yes.
It's like whack-a-mole or something.
Exactly so. Shadow banks are, by definition, the institutions that are just outside the boundary of what you have chosen to regulate as banks.
Right.
When you move that boundary, you temporarily solve the problem.
Okay.
It's like putting weed killer down. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
it solves the problem for, a period of time, but then they adapt.
So what we kind of have to learn to live with them, I guess, or the prudential regulators do.
Yes, I mean, which isn't to say we shouldn't continue to play very close scrutiny to them, but the point I'm making is not that one shouldn't try and address the issue, but that simply moving the boundary and assuming that the participants will carry on doing what they're doing in the same way once you've made them regulated is not a correct way of viewing what will actually happen.
Right. Okay. Bill, do you have any, just sort of as a final word, as it were, what is your take on?
Yeah. I like the way Paul phrased it with, there'll be another round of shadow banks. I agree with that. Whenever we talk about banks and the relationship with shadow banks or how shadow banks aren't regulated, it's often almost always in the context of banks are at a disadvantage. I Maybe you'll not be surprised, but I think it's actually quite the opposite. I think regulated entities have quite an advantage over the non-regulated competition. Access to discount windows, other forms of emergency assistance, liquidity, deposit insurance. So these official sector backstops instill confidence in shareholders, other stakeholders, depositors. And if you look at the relatively very low cost of funding that banks enjoy versus some of the non-regulated firms, I actually think it's an advantage for banks to have this this regulatory backstop.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Well, I think that very neatly wraps it up. I'd really like to thank both of you for taking part. And if you'd like to listen to more regulatory podcasts, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. And you can also subscribe via Acast, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. And finally, I'd like to wish everyone listening to stay safe and well. Thank you.